Side 4. The Stars My Destination. Continuing on page 125.
I've got three leads to the man who gave the order to let me die. Three names. A cook in Rome named Porgy. A quack in Shanghai named Orel. And this man, Forrest. This is a combined operation. Society and search, understand?
I understand.
We've got 2 hours to rip Forrest open. Do you know the coordinates of the Aussie cannery, the company town?
I don't want any part of your Vorga revenge. I'm searching for my family.
This is a combined operation. Every way, he said with such detached savagery that she winced and at once jaunted.
When Foyle arrived in his tent in the 4 mile circus on Jarvis Beach, she was already changing into travel clothes. Foyle looked at her. Although he forced her to live in his tent for security reasons, he had never touched her again. Robin caught his glance, stopped changing, and waited. He shook his head.
That's all finished.
How interesting. You've given up rape.
Get dressed, he said, controlling himself. Tell them they've got 2 hours to get the camp up to Shanghai.
It was 12:30 when Foyle and Robin arrived at the front office of the Aussie Cannery Company town. They applied for identification tags and were greeted by the mayor himself.
Happy New Year,
he caroled.
Happy, happy, happy. Visiting? A pleasure to drive you around. Permit me.
He bundled them into a lush helicopter and took off.
Lots of visitors tonight. Ours is a friendly town, friendliest company town in the world.
The plane circled giant buildings.
That's our ice palace. Swimming baths on the left. Big dome is the ski jump. Snow all year round. Tropical gardens under that glass roof. Palms, parrots, orchids, fruit. There's our market. Theater? Got our own broadcasting company, too. 3D, 5S. Take a look at the football stadium. Two of our boys made All-American this year. Turner at Wright Rockney and Otis at Left Thorpe.
Do tell, Foyle murmured.
Yes, sir, we've got everything. Everything. You don't have to jaunt around the world looking for fun. Aussie Cannery brings the world to you. Our town's a little universe. Happiest little universe in the world.
Having absentee problems, I see.
The mayor refused to falter in his sales pitch.
Look down at the streets. See those bikes, motorcycles, cars? We can afford more luxury transportation per capita than any other town on earth. Look at those homes. Mansions. Our people are rich and happy. We keep 'em rich and happy.
But do you keep them?
What do you mean? Of course we.
You can tell us the truth. We're not job prospects. Do you keep them?
We can't keep 'em more than 6 months, the mayor groaned. It's a hell of a headache. We give 'em everything, but we can't hold on to 'em. They get the wanderlust and jaunt. Absenteeism's cut our production by 12%. We can't hold on to steady labor.
Nobody can.
There ought to be a law. Forrest, you said? Right here.
He landed them before a Swiss chalet, set in an acre of gardens, and took off, mumbling to himself. Foyle and Robin stepped before the door of the house, waiting for the monitor to pick them up and announce them. Instead, the door flashed red, and a white skull and crossbones appeared on it. A canned voice spoke.
Warning, this residence is man-trapped by the Lethal Defense Corporation of Sweden, R:77-23. You have been legally notified. What the hell? Foyle muttered. On New Year's Eve? Friendly fella. Let's try the back.
They walked around the chalet, pursued by the skull and crossbones, flashing at intervals, and the canned warning. At one side, they saw the top of a cellar window brightly illuminated and heard the muffled chant of voices.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Cellar Christians, Foyle exclaimed.
He and Robin peered through the window. 30 worshippers of assorted faiths were celebrating the new year with a combined and highly illegal service. The 24th century had not yet abolished God, but it had abolished organized religion.
No wonder the house is man-trapped, Foyle said. Filthy practices like that. Look, they've got a priest and a rabbi, and that thing behind them is a crucifix.
Did you ever stop to think what swearing is? Robin asked quietly. You say, Jesus and Jesus Christ. Do you know what that is?
Just swearing, that's all. Like ouch or damn.
No, it's religion. You don't know it, but there are 2,000 years of meaning behind words like that.
This is no time for dirty talk,
Foyle said impatiently.
Save it for later. Come on.
The rear of the chalet was a solid wall of glass, the picture window of a dimly lit, empty living room.
Down on your face, Foyle ordered. I'm going in.
Robin lay prone on the marble patio. Foyle triggered his body, accelerated into a lightning blur, and smashed a hole in the glass wall. Far down on the sound spectrum, he heard dull concussions. They were shots. Quick projectiles laced toward him. Foyle dropped to the floor and tuned his ears, sweeping from low bass to supersonic, until at last he picked up the hum of the man-trap control mechanism. He turned his head gently, pinpointed the location by binaural DF, wove in through the stream of shots, and demolished the mechanism. He decelerated.
Come in, quick!
Robin joined him in the living room, trembling. The cellar Christians were pouring up into the house somewhere, emitting the sounds of martyrs.
Wait here,
Foyle grunted. He accelerated, blurred through the house, located the cellar Christians in poses of frozen flight, and sorted through them. He returned to Robin and decelerated.
None of them is Forrest, he reported. Maybe he's upstairs. The back way, while they're going out the front. Come on!
They raced up the back stairs. On the landing, they paused to take bearings.
Have to work fast, Foyle muttered. Between the shots and the religion riot, the world and his wife will be joining around asking questions.
He broke off. A low mewling sound came from a door at the head of the stairs. Foyle sniffed.
Analog, he exclaimed. Must be Forrest. How about that? Religion in the cellar and dope upstairs.
What are you talking about?
I'll explain later. In here, I only hope he isn't on a gorilla kick.
Foyle went through the door like a diesel tractor. They were in a large, bare room. A heavy rope was suspended from the ceiling. A naked man was entwined with a rope midway in the air. He squirmed and slithered up and down the rope, emitting a mewling sound and a musky odor.
Python, Foyle said. That's a break. Don't go near him. He'll mash your bones if he touches you.
Voices below began to call, Forrest, what's all the shooting?
Happy New Year, Forrest. Where in hell's the celebration?
Here they come, Foyle grunted. Have to jaunt him out of here. Meet you back at the beach. Go.
He whipped a knife out of his pocket, cut the rope, swung the squirming man to his back, and jaunted. Robin was on the empty Jarvis Beach a moment before him. Foyle arrived with the squirming man, oozing over his neck and shoulders like a python, crushing him in a terrifying embrace. The red stigmata suddenly burst out on Foyle's face.
Sinbad, he said in a strangled voice. Old man of the sea. Quick, girl. Right pockets. Three over. Two down. Sting ampule. Let him have it anyway.
His voice was choked off. Robin opened the pocket, found a packet of glass beads, and took them out. Each bead had a bee sting end. She thrust the sting of an ampule into the writhing man's neck. He collapsed. Foyle shook him off and arose from the sand.
Christ, he muttered, massaging his throat.
He took a deep breath.
Blood and bowels. Control, he said, resuming his air of detached calm.
The scarlet tattooing faded from his face.
What was all that horror? Robin asked.
Analog. Psychiatric dope for psychotics. Illegal. A twitch has to release himself somehow, revert back to the primitive. He identifies with a particular kind of animal. Gorilla, grizzly, brood bull, wolf. Takes the dope and turns into the animal he admires. Forrest was queer for snakes, seems as if.
How do you know all this?
Told you I've been studying. Preparing for Vorga. This is one of the things I learned. Show you something else I've learned, if you're not chicken-livered. How to bring a twitch out of analog.
Foyle opened another pocket in his battle coveralls and got to work on Forrest. Robin watched for a moment, then uttered a horrified cry, turned and walked to the edge of the water. She stood staring blindly at the surf and the stars until the mewling and the twisting ceased, and Foyle called to her.
You can come back now.
Robin returned to find a shattered creature seated upright on the beach, gazing at Foyle with dull, sober eyes.
You're Forrest?
Who the hell are you?
You're Ben Forrest, leading spaceman.
formerly aboard the pristine Vorga. Forrest cried out in terror.
You were aboard the Vorga on September 16th, 2436.
The man sobbed and shook his head.
On September 16, you passed a wreck out near the asteroid belt. Wreck of the Nomad, your sister ship. She signaled for help. Vorga passed her by, left her to drift and die. Why did Vorga pass her by?
Forrest began to scream hysterically.
Who gave the order to pass her by?
Jesus, no! No, no!
The records are all gone from the Bonesse and Hugues files. Someone got to them before me. Who was that? Who was aboard Vorga? Who shipped with you? I want officers and crew. Who was in command?
No!
Forrest screamed.
No!
Foyle held a sheaf of banknotes before the hysterical man's face.
I'll pay for the information. 50,000. Analog for the rest of your life. Who gave the order to let me die, Forrest? Who?
The man smote the banknotes from Foyle's hand, leaped up, and ran down the beach. Foyle tackled him at the edge of the surf. Forrest fell headlong, his face in the water. Foyle held him there.
Who commanded Vorga, Forrest? Who gave the order?
You're drowning him, Robin cried.
Let him suffer a little. Water's easier than vacuum. I suffered for 6 months. Who gave the order, Forrest?
The man bubbled and choked. Foyle lifted his head out of the water.
What are you? Loyal? Crazy? Scared? Your kind would sell out for 5,000. I'm offering 50. 50,000 for information, you son of a bitch, or you die slow and hard.
The tattooing appeared on Foyle's face. He forced Forrest's head back into the water and held the struggling man. Robin tried to pull him off.
You're murdering him!
Foyle turned his terrifying face on Robin.
Get your hands off me, bitch! Who was aboard with you, Forrest? Who gave the order? Why?
Forrest twisted his head out of the water.
12 of us on Vorga!
He screamed.
Christ save me! There was me and Kip...
He jerked spasmodically and sagged. Foyle pulled his body out of the surf.
Go on, you and who? Kemp? Who else? Talk!
There was no response. Foyle examined the body.
Dead,
he growled.
Oh, my God, my God!
One lead shot to hell. Just when he was opening up. What a damned break!
He took a deep breath and drew calm about him like an iron cloak. The tattooing disappeared from his face. He adjusted his watch for 120 degrees east longitude.
Almost midnight in Shanghai. Let's go. Maybe we'll have better luck with Sergei Orel, pharmacist's mate off the Vorga. Don't look so scared. This is only the beginning. Go, girl. Jaunt.
Robin gasped. He saw that she was staring over his shoulder with an expression of incredulity. Foyle turned. A flaming figure loomed on the beach, a huge man with burning clothes and a hideously tattooed face. It was himself.
Christ!
Foyle exclaimed. He took a step toward his burning image, and abruptly it was gone. He turned to Robin, ashen and trembling.
Did you see that?
Yes.
What was it?
You.
For God's sake! Me? How's that possible? How...
It was you.
But...
He faltered, the strength and furious possession drained out of him.
Was it illusion? Hallucination?
I don't know. I saw two.
Christ almighty. To see yourself. Face to face. The clothes were on fire. Did you see that? What in God's name was it?
It was Gully Foyle,
Robin said.
Burning in hell.
All right.
Foyle burst out angrily.
It was me in hell, but I'm still going through with it. If I burn in hell, Vorgo, burn with me.
He pounded his palms together, stinging himself back to strength and purpose.
I'm still going through with it, by God. Shanghai next. Jaunt!
Chapter 10 At the costume ball in Shanghai, 4 Mile of Ceres electrified society by appearing as Death in Dürer's Death and the Maiden, with a dazzling blonde creature clad in transparent veils. a Victorian society which stifled its women in purdah and which regarded the 1920 gowns of the Peenemunde clan as excessively daring, was shocked, despite the fact that Robin Winsbury was chaperoning the pair. But when Fourmile revealed that the female was a magnificent android, there was an instant reversal of opinion in his favor. Society was delighted with the deception. The naked body, shameful in humans, was merely a sexless curiosity in androids. At midnight, Fourmile auctioned off the android to the gentleman of the ball.
The money to go to charity, Fourmile?
Certainly not. You know my slogan, not 1 cent for entropy. Do I hear 100 credits for this expensive and lovely creature? 100, gentlemen. She's all beauty and highly adaptable. 2. Thank you. 3.5. Thank you. I'm bid 5. 8. Thank you. Any more bids for this remarkable product of the resident genius of the 4 Mile Circus? She walks, she talks, she adapts. She has been conditioned to respond to the highest bidder. 9. Do I hear any more bids? Are you all done? Are you all through? Sold to Lord Yale for 900 credits.
Tumultuous applause and appalled ciphering. An android like that must have cost 90,000. How can he afford it?
Will you turn the money over to the android, Lord Yale? She will respond suitably. Until we meet again in Rome, ladies and gentlemen. The Borghese Palace at midnight. Happy New Year!
4 Mile had already departed when Lord Yale discovered, to the delight of himself and the other bachelors, that a double deception had been perpetrated. The android was, in fact, a living human creature, all beauty and highly adaptable. She responded magnificently to 900 credits. The trick was the smoking room story of the year. The stags waited eagerly to congratulate 4 Mile. But Foyle and Robin Winsbury were passing under a sign that read, "Double your jaunting or double your money back," in 7 languages, and entering the emporium of Dr. Sergei Orel, celestial enlarger of cranial capabilities. The waiting room was decorated with lurid brain charts demonstrating how Dr. Orel poulticed, cupped, balsamed, and electrolyzed the brain into double its capacity or double your money back. He also doubled your memory with antifebral purgatives, magnified your morals with tonic robberants, and adjusted all anguished psyches with Orel's epiolotic vulnerary. The waiting room was empty. Foyle opened a door at a venture. He and Robin had a glimpse of a long hospital ward. Foyle grunted in disgust.
A snow joint. Might have known he'd be running a dive for sick heads, too.
This den catered to disease collectors, the most hopeless of neurotic addicts. They lay in their hospital beds, suffering mildly from illegally induced paramesals, paraflu, paramalaria, devotedly attended by nurses in starched white uniforms, and avidly enjoying their illegal illness and the attention it brought.
"Look at them," Foyle said contemptuously. "Disgusting. If there's anything filthier than a religion junkie, it's a disease bird."
"Good evening,"
a voice spoke behind them. Foyle shut the door and turned. Dr. Sergei Orel bowed. The good doctor was crisp and sterile in the classic white cap, gown, and surgical mask of the medical clans, to which he belonged by fraudulent assertion only. He was short, swarthy, and olive-eyed, recognizably Russian by his name alone. More than a century of jaunting had so mingled the many populations of the world that racial types were disappearing.
"Didn't expect to find you open for business on New Year's Eve," Foyle said.
"Our Russian New Year comes 2 weeks later," Dr. Orel answered. "Step this way, please."
He pointed to a door and disappeared with a pop. The door revealed a long flight of stairs. As Foyle and Robin started up the stairs, Dr. Orel appeared above them.
"This way, please.
Oh, 1 moment." He disappeared and appeared again behind them.
"You forgot to close the door."
He shut the door and jaunted again. This time he reappeared high at the head of the stairs.
"In here, please."
"Showing off," Foyle muttered. "Double your jaunting or double your money back. All the same, he's pretty fast. I'll have to be faster."
They entered the consultation room. It was a glass-roofed penthouse. The walls were lined with gaudy but antiquated medical apparatus, a sedative bath machine, an electric chair for administering shock treatment to schizophrenics, and EKG analyzer for tracing psychotic patterns, old optical and electronic microscopes. The quack waited for them behind his desk. He jaunted to the door, closed it, jaunted back to his desk, bowed, indicated chairs, jaunted behind Robbins and held it for her, jaunted to the window and adjusted the shade, jaunted to the light switch and adjusted the lights, then reappeared behind his desk.
1 year ago, he smiled, I could not jaunt at all. Then I discovered the secret, the salutiferous abstersive, which...
Foyle touched his tongue to the switchboard wired into the nerve endings of his teeth. He accelerated. He arose without haste, stepped to the slow-motion figure, blue-hoo-fwa-mooing, behind the desk, took out a heavy sap, and scientifically smote Orell across the brow, concussing the frontal lobes and stunning the jaunt center. He picked the quack up and strapped him into the electric chair. All this took approximately 5 seconds. To Robin Winsbury, it was a blur of motion. Foyle decelerated. The quack opened his eyes, stirred, discovered where he was, and started in anger and perplexity.
You're Sergei Orell, pharmacist's mate off the Vorga, Foyle said quietly. You were aboard the Vorga on September 16th, 2436.
The anger and perplexity turned to terror.
On September 16, you passed a wreck out near the asteroid belt. It was the wreck of the Nomad. She signaled for help and Vorga passed her by. You left her to drift and die. Why?
Orell rolled his eyes but did not answer.
Who gave the order to pass me by? Who was willing to let me rot and die?
Orell began to gibber.
Who was aboard Vorga? Who shipped with you? Who was in command? I'm going to get an answer. Don't think I'm not, Foyle said with calm ferocity. I'll buy it or tear it out of you. Why was I left to die? Who told you to let me die?
Orell screamed.
I can't talk about... Wait, I'll tell...
He sagged. Foyle examined the body.
Dead, he muttered, just when he was ready to talk. Just like Forrest.
Murdered.
No, I never touched him. It was suicide.
Foyle cackled without humor.
You're insane.
No, I'm used. I didn't kill them. I forced them to kill themselves.
What nonsense is this?
They've been given sympathetic blocks. You know about SBs, girl? Intelligence uses them for espionage agents. Take a certain body of information you don't want told. Link it with the sympathetic nervous system that controls automatic respiration and heartbeat. As soon as the subject tries to reveal that information, the block comes down. The heart and lungs stop, the man dies. Your secret's kept. An agent doesn't have to worry about killing himself to avoid torture. It's been done for him.
It was done to these men?
Obviously.
But why?
How do I know? Refugee running isn't the answer. Vorga must have been operating worse rackets than that to take this precaution. But we've got a problem. Our last lead is Poggi in Rome. Angelo Poggi, chef's assistant off the Vorga. How are we going to get information out of him without...
He broke off. His image stood before him, silent, ominous, face burning blood red, clothes flaming. Foyle was paralyzed. He took a breath and spoke in a shaking voice.
Who are you? What are you...
The image disappeared. Foyle turned to Robin, moistening his lips.
Did you see it?
Her expression answered him.
Was it real?
She pointed to Sergei Orel's desk, alongside which the image had stood. Papers on the desk had caught fire and were burning briskly. Foyle backed away, still frightened and bewildered. He passed a hand across his face. It came away wet. Robin rushed to the desk and tried to beat out the flames. She picked up wads of paper and letters and slammed helplessly. Foyle did not move.
I can't stop it,
she gasped at last.
We've got to get out of here.
Foyle nodded, then pulled himself together with power and resolution.
Rome, he croaked. We jaunt to Rome. There's got to be some explanation for this. I'll find it, by God.
And in the meantime, I'm not quitting. Rome. Go, girl. Jaunt.
Since the Middle Ages, the Spanish Stairs have been the center of corruption in Rome, rising from the Piazza di Spagna to the gardens of the Villa Borghese in a broad, long sweep. The Spanish Stairs are, have been, and always will be, swarming with vice. Pimps lounge on the stairs, whores, perverts, lesbians, catamites. Insolent and arrogant, they display themselves and jeer at the respectables who sometimes pass. The Spanish stairs were destroyed in the fishing wars of the late 20th century. They were rebuilt and destroyed again in the War of the World Restoration in the 21st century. Once more they were rebuilt, and this time covered over with blast-proof crystal, turning the stairs into a stepped galleria. The dome of the galleria cut off the view from the death chamber in Keats's house. No longer would visitors peep through the narrow window and see the last sight that met the dying poet's eyes. Now they saw the smoky dome of the Spanish stairs, and through it the distorted figures of corruption below. The galleria of the stairs was illuminated at night, and this New Year's Eve was chaotic. For 1,000 years, Rome has welcomed the New Year with a bombardment. Firecrackers, rockets, torpedoes, gunshots, bottles, shoes, old pots and pans. For months, Romans save junk to be hurled out of top-floor windows when midnight strikes. The roar of fireworks inside the stairs and the clatter of debris clashing on the galleria roof were deafening as Foyle and Robin Winsberry climbed down from the carnival in the Borghese Palace. They were still in costume, Foyle in the livid crimson and black tights and doublet of Cesare Borgia, Robin wearing the silver-encrusted gown of Lucrezia Borgia. They wore grotesque velvet masks. The contrast between their Renaissance costumes and the modern clothes around them brought forth jeers and catcalls. Even the Lobos who frequented the Spanish stairs, the unfortunate habitual criminals who had had a quarter of their brains burned out by prefrontal lobotomy, were aroused from their dreary apathy to stare. The mob seethed around the couple as they descended the galleria.
Poggi, Foyle called quietly. Angelo Poggi.
A bawd bellowed anatomical adjurations at him.
Poggi. Angelo Poggi. Foyle was impassive. I'm told he can be found on the stairs at night. Angelo Poggi.
A whore aligned his mother.
Angelo Poggi. 10 credits to anyone who brings me to him.
Foyle was ringed with extended hands, some filthy, some scented, all greedy. He shook his head.
Show me first.
Roman rage crackled around him.
Poggi. Angelo Poggi.
After 6 weeks of loitering on the Spanish stairs, Captain Peter Yang Yeovil at last heard the words he had hoped to hear. 6 weeks of tedious assumption of the identity of one Angelo Poggi, chef's assistant off the Vorga, long dead, was finally paying off. It had been a gamble, first risked when intelligence had brought the news to Captain Yang Yeovil that someone was making cautious inquiries about the crew of the pristine Vorga and paying heavily for information.
It's a long shot, Yang Yeovil had said. But Gully Foyle, AS-128/127:006, did make that lunatic attempt to blow up Vorga. And 20 pounds of pyre is worth a long shot.
Now he waddled up the stairs toward the man in the Renaissance costume and mask. He had put on 40 pounds weight with glandular shots. He had darkened his complexion with diet manipulation. His features, never of an Oriental cast, but cut more along the hawk-line lines of the ancient American Indian, easily fell into an unreliable pattern with a little muscular control. The intelligence man waddled up the Spanish stairs, a gross cook with a larcenous countenance. He extended a package of soiled envelopes toward Foyle.
Filthy pictures, signore. Sella Christians, kneeling, praying, singing psalms, kissing cross. Very naughty. Very smutty, signore. Entertain your friends. Excite the ladies.
No, Foyle brushed the pornography aside. I'm looking for Angelo Poggi.
Yang Yeovil signaled microscopically. His crew on the stairs began photographing and recording the interview without ceasing its pimping and whoring. The secret speech of the intelligence tongue of the inner planet's armed forces wigwagged around Foyle and Robin in a hail of tiny ticks, sniffs, gestures, attitudes, motions. It was the ancient Chinese sign language of eyelids, eyebrows, fingertips, and infinitesimal body motions.
Signore? Yan Yovel wheezed. Angelo Poggi? Si, signore. I am Angelo Poggi.
Chef's assistant off the Vorga? Expecting the same start of terror manifested by Forrest and Orel, which he at last understood, Foyle shot out a hand and grabbed Yan Yovel's elbow.
Yes? Si, signore.
Yan Yovel replied tranquilly.
How can I serve your worship?
Maybe this one can come through, Foyle murmured to Robin.
He's not scared. Maybe he knows a way around the block.
I want information from you, Poggi.
Of what nature, signore? And at what price?
I want to buy all you've got. Anything you've got. Name your price.
But, signore, I am a man full of years and experience. I am not to be bought in wholesale lots. I must be paid item by item. Make your selection, and I will name the price. What do you want?
You were aboard Vorga on September 16th, 2436?
The cost of that item is 10 credits.
Foyle smiled mirthlessly and paid.
I was, signore.
I want to know about a ship you passed out near the asteroid belt, the wreck of the Nomad. You passed her on September 16th. Nomad signaled for help, and Vorga passed her by. Who gave that order?
Ah, signore.
Who gave you that order, and why?
Why do you ask, signore?
Never mind why I ask. Name the price and talk.
I must know why a question is asked before I answer, signore.
Yan Yovel smiled greasily.
And I will pay for my caution by cutting the price. Why are you interested in Vorga and Nomad and this shocking abandonment in space? Were you, perhaps, the unfortunate who was so cruelly treated?
He's not Italian. His accent's perfect, but the speech pattern's all wrong. No Italian would frame sentences like that. Foyle stiffened in alarm. Yang Yovel's eyes, sharpened to detect and deduce from minutiae, caught the change in attitude. He realized at once that he had slipped somehow. He signaled to his crew urgently. A white-hot brawl broke out on the Spanish stairs. In an instant, Foyle and Robin were caught up in a screaming, struggling mob. The crews of the intelligence Tong were past masters of this OP-I maneuver, designed to outwit a jaunting world. Their split-second timing could knock any man off balance and strip him for identification. Their success was based on the simple fact that between unexpected assault and defensive response, there must always be a recognition lag. Within the space of that lag, the intelligence Tong guaranteed to prevent any man from saving himself. In 3/5 of a second, Foyle was battered, kneed, hammered across the forehead, dropped to the steps, and spread-eagled. The mask was plucked from his face, portions of his clothes torn away, and he was ripe and helpless for the rape of the identification cameras. Then, for the first time in the history of the Tong, their schedule was interrupted. A man appeared, straddling Foyle's body. A huge man with a hideously tattooed face and clothes that smoked and flamed. The apparition was so appalling that the crew stopped dead and stared. A howl went up from the crowd on the stairs at the dreadful spectacle.
The Burning Man! Look! The Burning Man!
But that's Foyle, Yan Yovel whispered. For perhaps a quarter of a minute, the apparition stood, silent, burning, staring with blind eyes. Then it disappeared. The man spread-eagled on the ground and disappeared, too. He turned into a lightning blur of action that whipped through the crew, locating and destroying cameras, recorders, all identification apparatus. Then the blur seized the girl in the Renaissance gown and vanished. The Spanish stairs came to life again, painfully, as though struggling out of a nightmare. The bewildered intelligence crew clustered around Yan Yovel.
What in God's name was that, yo?
I think it was our man, Gully Foyle. You saw that tattooed face.
And the burning clothes.
Looked like a witch at the stake. But if that burning man was Foyle, who in hell were we wasting our time on?
I don't know. Does the Commando Brigade have an intelligence service they haven't bothered to mention to us?
Why the Commandos, yo?
You saw the way he accelerated, didn't you?
He destroyed every record we made.
I still can't believe my eyes.
Oh, you can believe what you didn't see, all right. That was top-secret commando technique. They take their men apart and rewire and regear them. I'll have to check with Mars HQ and find out whether commando brigades running a parallel investigation.
Does the Army tell the Navy?
They'll tell intelligence, Yang Yovel said angrily. This case is critical enough without jurisdictional hassles. And another thing, there was no need to manhandle that girl in the maneuver. It was undisciplined and unnecessary.
Yang Yovel paused, for once unaware of the significant glances passing around him.
I must find out who she is, he added dreamily. If she's been regeared, too, it'll be real interesting, yo, a bland voice, markedly devoid of implication, said. Boy meets commando.
Yang Yovel flushed.
All right, he blurted. I'm transparent. Just repetitious, yo. All your romances start the same way. There's no need to manhandle that girl. And then Dolly Quaker, Jean Webster, Gwyn Roget, Marion...
No names, please,
a shocked voice interrupted. Does Romeo tell Juliet? You're all going on latrine assignment tomorrow, Yang Yovel said. I'm damned if I'll stand for this salacious insubordination. No, not tomorrow, but as soon as this case is closed.
His hawk face darkened.
My God, what a mess. Will you ever forget Foyle standing there like a burning brand? But where is he? What's he up to? What's it all mean?
Chapter 11. Pristine of Pristine's mansion in Central Park was ablaze for the new year. Charming antique electric bulbs with zigzag filaments and pointed tips shed yellow light. The jaunt-proof maze had been removed, and the great door was open for the special occasion. The interior of the house was protected from the gaze of the crowd outside by a jeweled screen just inside the door. The sightseers buzzed and exclaimed as the famous and near-famous of clan and sept arrived by car, by coach, by litter, by every form of luxurious transportation. Pristine of Pristine himself stood before the door, iron gray, handsome, smiling his basilisk smile, and welcomed society to his open house. Hardly had a celebrity stepped through the door and disappeared behind a screen when another, even more famous, came clattering up in a vehicle even more fabulous. The Colas arrived in a bandwagon. The Esso family, 6 sons, 3 daughters, was magnificent in a glass-topped Greyhound bus. But Greyhound arrived, in an Edison electric runabout, hard on their heels, and there was much laughter and chaffing at the door. But when Edison of Westinghouse dismounted from his Esso-fueled gasoline buggy, completing the circle, the laughter on the steps turned into a roar. Just as the crowd of guests turned to enter Pristine's home, a distant commotion attracted their attention. It was a rumble, a fierce chatter of pneumatic punches, and an outrageous metallic bellowing. It approached rapidly. The outer fringe of sightseers opened a broad lane. A heavy truck rumbled down the lane. 6 men were tumbling balks of timber out the back of the truck. Following them came a crew of 20, arranging the balks neatly in rows. Pristine and his guests watched with amazement. A giant machine, bellowing and pounding, approached, crawling over the ties. Behind it were deposited parallel rails of welded steel. Crews with sledges and pneumatic punches spiked the rails to the timber ties. The track was laid to Pristine's door in a sweeping arc and then curved away. The bellowing engine and crews disappeared into the darkness.
Good God, Pristine was distinctly heard to say.
Guests poured out of the house to watch. A shrill whistle sounded in the distance. Down the track came a man on a white horse carrying a large red flag. Behind him panted a steam locomotive drawing a single observation car. The train stopped before Pristine's door. A conductor swung down from the car, followed by a Pullman porter. The porter arranged steps. A lady and gentleman in evening clothes descended.
"Shan't be long," the gentleman told the conductor. "Come back for me in an hour."
"Good God!" Pristine exclaimed again. The train puffed off. The couple mounted the steps.
"Good evening, Pristine," the gentleman said. Terribly sorry about that horse messing up your grounds, but the old New York franchise still insists on the red flag in front of trains.
4 mile,
the guests shouted.
4 mile of series,
the sightseers cheered. Pristine's party was now an assured success. Inside the vast velvet and plush reception hall, Pristine examined 4 mile curiously. Foyle endured the keen, iron-gray gaze with equanimity, meanwhile nodding and smiling to the enthusiastic admirers he had acquired from Canberra to New York, with whom Robin Winsbury was chatting. Control, he thought. Blood, bowels, and brain. He grilled me in his office for 1 hour after that crazy attempt I made on Vorga. Will he recognize me?
Your face is familiar, Pristine,
4 mile said.
Have we met before? I have not had the honor of meeting a 4 mile until tonight,
Pristine answered ambiguously. Foyle had trained himself to read men, but Pristine's hard, handsome face was inscrutable. Standing face to face, the one detached and compelled, the other reserved and indomitable, they looked like a pair of brazen statues at white heat on the verge of running molten.
I'm told that you boast of being an upstart, 4 mile. Yes, I've patterned myself after the first Pristine.
Indeed.
You will remember that he boasted of starting the family fortune in the plasma black market during the Third World War.
It was the Second War, 4 mile, but the hypocrites of our clan never acknowledge him.
The name was Payne, then.
I hadn't known.
And what was your unhappy name before you changed it to 4 mile?
It was Pristine.
Indeed.
The basilisk smile acknowledged the hit.
You claim a relationship with our clan?
I will claim it in time.
Of what degree?
But say, a blood relationship.
How interesting. I detect a certain fascination for blood in you, 4 mile.
No doubt a family weakness, Pristine.
You're pleased to be cynical, Pristine said, not without cynicism. But you speak the truth. We have always had a fatal weakness for blood and money. It is our vice, I admit it.
And I share it.
A passion for blood and money?
Indeed I do. Most passionately.
Without mercy? Without forgiveness? Without hypocrisy?
Without mercy. Without forgiveness. Without hypocrisy.
4 mile, you are a young man after my own heart. If you do not claim a relationship with our clan, I shall be forced to adopt you.
You're too late, Pristine. I've already adopted you.
Pristine took Foyle's arm.
You must be presented to my daughter, Lady Olivia. Will you allow me?
They crossed the reception hall. Foyle hesitated, wondering whether he should call Robin to his side for impending emergencies, but he was too triumphant.
He doesn't know. He'll never know.
Then doubt came. But I'll never know if he does know. He's crucible steel. He could teach me a thing or two about control. Acquaintances hailed 4 mile.
Wonderful deception you worked in Shanghai.
Marvelous carnival in Rome, wasn't it?
Did you hear about the burning man who appeared on the Spanish stairs? We looked for you in London.
What a heavenly entrance that was, Harry Sherwin-Williams called. Outdid us all, 4 mile. Made us look like a pack of damned pikers.
You forget yourself, Harry, Pristine said coldly. You know I permit no profanity in my home.
Sorry, Pristine. Where's the circus now, 4 mile?
I don't know, Foyle said. Just a moment.
A crowd gathered, grinning in anticipation of the latest 4 mile folly. He took out a platinum watch and snapped open the case. The face of a valet appeared on the dial.
Whatever your name is, where are we staying just now?
The answer was tiny and tinny.
You gave orders to make New York your permanent residence, 4 mile?
Oh, did I? And?
We bought St. Patrick's Cathedral, 4 mile.
And where is that?
Old St. Patrick's, 4 mile, on Fifth Avenue and what was formerly 50th Street. We've pitched the camp inside.
Thank you.
4 mile closed the platinum hunter.
My address is Old St. Patrick's, New York.
There's one thing to be said for the outlawed religions. At least they built churches big enough to house a circus.
Olivia Pristine was seated on a dais, surrounded by admirers paying court to this beautiful albino daughter of Pristine. She was strangely and wonderfully blind, for she could see in the infrared only, from 7,500 angstroms to 1 millimeter wavelengths, far below the normal visible spectrum. She saw heat waves, magnetic fields, radio waves. She saw her admirers in a strange light of organic emanations against a background of red radiation. She was a snow maiden, an ice princess with coral eyes and coral lips, imperious, mysterious, unattainable. Foyle looked at her once and lowered his eyes in confusion before the blind gaze that could only see him as electromagnetic waves and infrared light. His pulse began to beat faster. 100 lightning fantasies about himself and Olivia Pristine flashed in his heart.
"Don't be a fool," he thought desperately. "Control yourself. Stop dreaming. This can be dangerous."
He was introduced, was addressed in a husky, silvery voice, was given a cool, slim hand, but the hand seemed to explode within his with an electric shock. It was almost a start of mutual recognition, almost a joining of emotional impact.
"This is insane. She's a symbol, the dream princess, the unattainable. Control."
He was fighting so hard that he scarcely realized he had been dismissed, graciously and indifferently. He could not believe it. He stood gaping like a lout. "What? Are you still here, Fourmile?"
"I couldn't believe I'd been dismissed, Lady Olivia."
"Hardly that. But I'm afraid you are in the way of my friends."
"I'm not used to being dismissed."
"No, no, all wrong.
At least by someone I'd like to count as a friend."
"Don't be tedious, Fourmile. Do step down."
"How have I offended you?"
"Offended me? Now you're being ridiculous."
"Lady Olivia."
"Can't I say anything right? Where's Robin?"
"Can we start again, please?"
"If you're trying to be gauche, Fourmile, you're succeeding admirably."
"Your hand again, please. Thank you. I'm Fourmile of Ceres."
"All right," she laughed. "I'll concede you're a clown. Now do step down. I'm sure you can find someone to amuse."
"What's happened this time?"
"Really, sir, are you trying to make me angry?"
"No."
"Yes, I am. Trying to touch you somehow. Cut through the ice."
"The first time our hand clasp was violent. Now it's nothing. What happened?"
"Fourmile," Olivia said wearily, "I'll concede that you're amusing, original, witty, fascinating. Anything if you will only go away." He stumbled off the dais.
"Bitch, bitch, bitch. No, she's the dream, just as I dreamed her. The icy pinnacle to be stormed and taken, to lay siege, invade, ravish, forced to her knees."
He came face to face with Saul Dagenham. He stood paralyzed, coercing blood and bowels.
"Ah, Fourmile," Pristine said. "This is Saul Dagenham. He can only give us 30 minutes, and he insists on spending one of them with you."
"Does he know? Did he send for Dagenham to make sure? Attack. Toujours de l'audace." "What happened to your face, Dagenham?" Fourmile asked with detached curiosity.
The death's head smiled.
"And I thought I was famous. Radiation poisoning. I'm hot. Time was when they said hotter than a pistol. Now they say hotter than Dagenham."
The deadly eyes raked Foyle.
"What's behind that circus of yours?"
"A passion for notoriety."
"I'm an old hand at camouflage myself. I recognize the signs. What's your larceny?"
"Did Dillinger tell Capone?"
Foyle smiled back, beginning to relax, restraining his triumph.
"I've outfaced them both." "You look happier, Dagenham."
Instantly he realized the slip. Dagenham picked it up in a flash.
"Happier than when? Where did we meet before?"
"Not happier than when, happier than me."
Foyle turned to Pristine.
"I've fallen desperately in love with Lady Olivia."
"Saul, your half hour's up."
Dagenham and Pristine, on either side of Foyle, turned. A tall woman approached, stately in an emerald evening gown, her red hair gleaming. It was Gisbella McQueen. Their glances met. Before the shock could seethe into his face, Foyle turned, ran 6 steps to the first door he saw, opened it and darted through. The door slammed behind him. He was in a short, blind corridor. There was a click, a pause, and then a canned voice spoke courteously. "You have invaded a private portion of this residence. Please retire." Foyle gasped and struggled with himself. "You have invaded a private portion of this residence. Please retire."
"I never knew. Thought she was killed out there. She recognized me."
"You have invaded a private portion of this residence. Please retire."
"I'm finished. She'll never forgive me. Must be telling Dagenham and Pristine now."
The door from the reception hall opened, and for a moment Foyle thought he saw his flaming image. Then he realized he was looking at Gisbella's flaming hair. She made no move, just stood and smiled at him in furious triumph. He straightened.
"By God, I won't go down whining."
Without haste, Foyle sauntered out of the corridor, took Gisbella's arm, and led her back to the reception hall. He never bothered to look around for Dagenham or Pristine. They would present themselves with force and arms in due time. He smiled at Gisbella. She smiled back, still in triumph.
"Thanks for running away, Gully. I never dreamed it could be so satisfying."
"Running away? My dear Jiz."
"Well?"
"I can't tell you how lovely you're looking tonight. We've come a long way from Zuffa Martel, haven't we?"
Foyle motioned to the ballroom.
"Dance?"
Her eyes widened in surprise at his composure. She permitted him to escort her to the ballroom and take her in his arms.
"By the way, Jiz, how did you manage to keep out of Zuffa Martel?"
"Dagenham arranged it." "So, you dance now, Gully?"
"I dance, speak 4 languages miserably, study science and philosophy, write pitiful poetry, blow myself up with idiotic experiments, fence like a fool, box like a buffoon. In short, I'm the notorious 4 Mile of Ceres."
"No longer Gully Foyle."
"Only to you, dear, and whoever you've told."
"Just Dagenham. Are you sorry I blew your secret?"
"You couldn't help yourself any more than I could."
"No, I couldn't. Your name just popped out of me. What would you have paid me to keep my mouth shut?"
"Don't be a fool, Jiz. This accident's going to earn you about 17,980,000 credits."
"What do you mean?"
"I told you I'd give you whatever was left over after I finished Vorga."
"You've finished Vorga?" she said in surprise.
"No, dear, you've finished me. But I'll keep my promise."
She laughed.
"Generous Gully Foyle. Be real generous, Gully. Make a run for it. Entertain me a little."
"Squealing like a rat? I don't know how, Jiz. I'm trained for hunting, nothing else."
"And I killed the tiger. Give me one satisfaction, Gully. Say you were close to Vorga. I ruined you when you were half a step from the finish. Yes?"
"I wish I could, Jiz, but I can't. I'm nowhere. I was trying to pick up another lead here tonight."
"Poor Gully. Maybe I can help you out of this jam. I can say, oh, that I made a mistake. Or a joke. That you really aren't Gully Foyle. I know how to confuse Saul. I can do it, Gully. If you still love me."
He looked down at her and shook his head.
"It's never been love between us, Jiz. You know that. I'm too one-track to be anything but a hunter."
"Too one-track to be anything but a fool."
"What did you mean, Jiz? Dagenham arranged to keep you out of Zuffa Martel. You know how to confuse Saul Dagenham? What have you got to do with him?"
"I work for him. I'm one of his couriers."
"You mean he's blackmailing you? Threatening to send you back if you don't..."
"No. We hit it off the minute we met. He started off capturing me. I ended up capturing him."
"How do you mean?"
"Can't you guess?" He stared at her. Her eyes were veiled, but he understood.
"Jiz, with him?"
"Yes."
"But how? He..."
"There are precautions. I don't want to talk about it, Gully."
"Sorry." He's a long time returning.
Returning?
Dagenham with his army.
Oh, yes, of course.
Gisbella laughed again, then spoke in a low, furious tone.
You don't know what a tightrope you've been walking, Gully. If you'd begged or bribed or tried to romance me, by God, I'd have ruined you. I'd have told the world who you were, screamed it from the housetops.
What are you talking about?
Saul isn't returning. He doesn't know. You can go to hell on your own.
I don't believe you.
Do you think it would take him this long to get you, Saul Dagenham?
But why didn't you tell him, after the way I ran out on you?
Because I don't want him going to hell with you. I'm not talking about Vorga. I mean something else. Pyre. That's why they hunted you. That's what they're after. 20 pounds of pyre.
What's that?
When you got the safe open, was there a small box in it, made of ILI, inert lead isomer?
Yes.
What was inside the ILI box?
20 slugs that looked like compressed iodine crystals.
What did you do with the slugs?
Sent 2 out for analysis. No one could find out what they are. I'm trying to run an analysis on a 3rd in my lab, but I'm not clowning for the public.
Oh, you are you? Why?
I'm growing up, Jez, Foyle said gently. It didn't take much to figure out that was what Pristine and Dagenham were after.
Where have you got the rest of the slugs?
In a safe place.
They're not safe. They can't ever be safe. I don't know what pyre is, but I know it's the road to hell, and I don't want Saul walking it.
You love him that much?
I respect him that much. He's the first man that ever showed me an excuse for the double standard.
Chiz, what is pyre? You know.
I've guessed. I've pieced together the hints I've heard. I've got an idea. And I could tell you, Gully. But I won't.
The fury in her face was luminous.
I'm running out on you this time. I'm leaving you to hang helpless in the dark. See what it feels like, boy. Enjoy.
She broke away from him and swept across the ballroom floor. At that moment, the first bombs fell. They came in like meteor swarms, not so many, but far more deadly. They came in on the morning quadrant, that quarter of the globe in darkness from midnight to dawn. They collided head-on with the forward side of the Earth in its revolution around the sun. They had been traveling a distance of 400 million miles. Their excessive speed was matched by the rapidity of the Terran defense computers, which traced and intercepted these New Year gifts from the outer satellites within the space of microseconds. A multitude of fierce new stars prickled in the sky and vanished. They were bombs detected and detonated 500 miles above their target. But so narrow was the margin between speed of defense and speed of attack that many got through. They shot through the aurora level, the meteor level, the twilight limit, the stratosphere, and down to Earth. The invisible trajectories ended in titanic convulsions. The first atomic explosion, which destroyed Newark, shook the pristine mansion with an unbelievable quake. Floors and walls shuddered, and the guests were thrown in heaps along with furniture and decorations. Quake followed quake as the random shower descended around New York. They were deafening, numbing, chilling. The sounds, the shocks, the flares of lurid light on the horizon were so enormous that reason was stripped from humanity, leaving nothing but flayed animals to shriek, cower, and run. Within the space of 5 seconds, Pristine's New Year party was transformed from elegance into anarchy. Foyle arose from the floor. He looked at the struggling bodies on the ballroom parquet, saw Gisbella fighting to free herself, took a step toward her, and then stopped. He revolved his head dazedly, feeling it was no part of him. The thunder never ceased. He saw Robin Winsbury in the reception hall, reeling and battered. He took a step toward her and then stopped again. He knew where he must go. He accelerated. The thunder and lightning dropped down the spectrum to grinding and flickering. The shuddering quakes turned into greasy undulations. Foyle blurred through the giant house, searching, until at last he found her, standing in the garden, standing tiptoe on a marble bench, looking like a marble statue to his accelerated senses, the statue of exaltation. He decelerated. Sensation leaped up the spectrum again, and once more he was buffeted by that bigger-than-death-size bombardment.
"Lady Olivia," he called.
"Who is that?"
"The clown."
"4 Mile?"
"Yes."
"And you came searching for me?" "I'm touched, really touched."
"You're insane to be standing out here like this. I beg you to let me..."
"No, no, no. It's beautiful. Magnificent."
"Let me jaunt with you to some place that's safe."
"Ah, you see yourself as a knight in armor, chivalry to the rescue. It doesn't suit you, my dear. You haven't the flair for it. You'd best go."
"I'll stay."
"As a beauty lover?"
"As a lover."
"You're still tedious, 4 Mile. Come, be inspired. This is Armageddon, flowering monstrosity. Tell me what you see."
"There's nothing much," he answered, looking around and wincing. "There's light all over the horizon, quick clouds of it. Above, there's a sort of sparkling effect, like Christmas lights twinkling."
"Oh, you see so little with your eyes. See what I see. There's a dome in the sky, a rainbow dome. The colors run from deep tang to brilliant burn. That's what I've named the colors I see. What would that dome be?"
"The radar screen," Foyle muttered.
"And then there are vasty shafts of fire thrusting up and swaying, weaving, dancing, sweeping. What are they?"
"Interceptor beams. You're seeing the whole electronic defense system."
"And I can see the bombs coming down, too. Quick streaks of what you call red. But not your red, mine. Why can I see them?"
"They're heated by air friction. But the inert lead casing doesn't show the color to us."
"See how much better you're doing as Galileo than Galahad. Oh, there's one coming down in the east. Watch for it. It's coming, coming, coming. Now!"
A flare of light on the eastern horizon proved it was not her imagination.
"There's another to the north. Very close. Very. Now!"
A shock tore down from the north.
"And the explosions, 4 Mile, they're not just clouds of light. They're fabrics, webs, tapestries of meshing colors. So beautiful, like exquisite shrouds."
"Which they are, Lady Olivia."
"Are you afraid?"
"Yes."
"Then run away."
"No."
"Ah, you're defiant."
"I don't know what I am. I'm scared, but I won't run."
"Then you're brazening it out, making a show of knightly courage."
The husky voice sounded amused.
"Just think, 4 Mile. How long does it take to jaunt? You could be safe in seconds. In Mexico, Canada, Alaska. So safe. There must be millions there now. We're probably the last left in the city."
"Not everybody can jaunt so far and so fast."
"Then we're the last left to count. Why don't you leave me? Be safe. I'll be killed soon. No one will ever know your pretense turned tail."
"Bitch."
"Ah, you're angry. What shocking language. It's the first sign of weakness. Why don't you exercise your better judgment and carry me off? That would be the second sign."
"Damn you."
He stepped close to her, clenching his fists in rage. She touched his cheek with a cool, quiet hand, but once again there was that electric shock.
"No, it's too late, my dear," she said quietly. "Here comes a whole cluster of red streaks. Down, 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 directly at us. There'll be no escaping this. Quick now, run, jaunt, take me with you, quick, quick."
He swept her off the bench.
"Bitch, never."
He held her, found the soft coral mouth and kissed her, bruised her lips with his, waiting for the final blackout. The concussion never came.
"Tripped,"
he exclaimed. She laughed. He kissed her again and at last forced himself to release her. She gasped for breath, then laughed again, her coral eyes blazing.
"It's over," she said.
"It hasn't begun yet."
"What do you mean?"
"The war between us."
"Make it a human war," she said fiercely. "You're the first not to be deceived by my looks. Oh, God, the boredom of the chivalrous knights and their milk-warm passion for the fairy-tale princess. But I'm not like that inside. I'm not, never. Make it a savage war between us. Don't win me. Destroy me."
Suddenly she was Lady Olivia again, the gracious snow maiden.
I'm afraid the bombardment has finished, my dear Fourmile. The show is over. But what an exciting prelude to the new year. Good night.
Good night,
he echoed incredulously. Good night, she repeated. Really, my dear Fourmile, are you so gauche that you never know when you're dismissed? You may go now. Good night.
He hesitated, searched for words, and at last turned and lurched out of the house. He was trembling with elation and confusion. He walked in a daze, scarcely aware of the confusion and disaster around him. The horizon now was lit with the light of red flames. The shock waves of the assault had stirred the atmosphere so violently that winds still whistled in strange gusts. The tremor of the explosions had shaken the city so hard that brick, cornice, glass, and metal were tumbling and crashing. And this despite the fact that no direct hit had been made on New York. The streets were empty. The city was deserted. The entire population of New York, of every city, had jaunted in a desperate search for safety, to the limit of their ability. 5 miles, 50 miles, 500 miles. Some had jaunted into the center of a direct hit. Thousands died in jaunt explosions, for the public jaunt stages had never been designed to accommodate the crowding of mass exodus. Foyle became aware of white-armored disaster crews appearing on the streets. An imperious signal directed at him warned him that he was about to be summarily drafted for disaster work. The problem of jaunting was not to get populations out of cities, but to force them to return and restore order. Foyle had no intention of spending a week fighting fire and looters. He accelerated and evaded the disaster crew. At Fifth Avenue, he decelerated. The drain of acceleration on his energy was so enormous that he was reluctant to maintain it for more than a few moments. Long periods of acceleration demanded days of recuperation. The looters and jack-jaunters were already at work on the avenue, singly, in swarms, furtive yet savage, jackals rending the body of a living but helpless animal. They descended on Foyle. Anything was their prey tonight.
I'm not in the mood, he told them. Play with somebody else.
He emptied the money out of his pockets and tossed it to them. They snapped it up, but were not satisfied. They desired entertainment, and he was obviously a helpless gentleman. Half a dozen surrounded Foyle and closed in to torment him.
Kind gentlemen, they smiled. We're going to have a party.
Foyle had once seen the mutilated body of one of their party guests. He sighed and detached his mind from visions of Olivia Pristine.
All right, jackals, he said. Let's have a party.
They prepared to send him into a screaming dance. Foyle tripped the switchboard in his mouth and became, for 12 devastating seconds, the most murderous machine ever devised, the Commando Killer. It was done without conscious thought or volition. His body merely followed the directive taped into muscle and reflex. He left 6 bodies stretched on the street. Old St. Pat's still stood, unblemished, eternal, the distant fires flickering on the green copper of its roof. Inside, it was deserted. The tents of the 4 Mile Circus filled the nave, illuminated and furnished, but the circus personnel was gone. Servants, chefs, valets, athletes, philosophers, camp followers, and crooks had fled.
But they'll be back to loot, Foyle murmured.
He entered his own tent. The first thing he saw was a figure in white, crouched on a rug, crooning sunnily to itself. It was Robin Winsbury, her gown in tatters, her mind in tatters.
Robin!
She went on crooning wordlessly. He pulled her up, shook her, and slapped her. She beamed and crooned. He filled a syringe and gave her a tremendous shot of niacin. The sobering wrench of the drug on her pathetic flight from reality was ghastly. Her satin skin turned ashen. The beautiful face twisted. She recognized Foyle, remembered what she had tried to forget, screamed and sank to her knees. She began to cry.
That's better, he told her. You're a great one for escape, aren't you? First suicide, now this. What next?
Go away.
Probably religion. I can see you joining a cellar sect with passwords like Pax Vobiscum, Bible smuggling and martyrdom for the faith. Can't you ever face up to anything?
Don't you ever run away?
Never. Escape is for cripples. Neurotics.
Neurotics. The favorite word of the Johnny-come-lately educated. You're so educated, aren't you? So
poised, so balanced. You've been running away all your life.
Me? Never. I've been hunting all my life.
You've been running. Haven't you ever heard of attack escape? To run away from reality by attacking it, denying it, destroying it. That's what you've been doing.
Attack escape? Foyle was brought up with a jolt. You mean I've been running away from something?
Obviously.
From what?
From reality. You can't accept life as it is. You refuse. You attack it. Try to force it into your own pattern. You attack and destroy everything that stands in the way of your own insane pattern.
She lifted her tear-stained face.
I can't stand it anymore. I want you to let me go.
Go where?
To live my own life.
What about your family?
And find them my own way.
Why? What now?
It's too much. You end the war, because you're as bad as the war. Worse. What happened to me tonight is what happens to me every moment I'm with you. I can stand one or the other, not both.
No, he said. I need you.
I'm prepared to buy my way out.
How?
You've lost all your leads to Vorga, haven't you?
And?
I've found another.
Where?
Never mind where. Will you agree to let me go if I turn it over to you?
I can take it from you.
Go ahead, take it. Her eyes flashed. If you know what it is, you won't have any trouble.
I can make you give it to me.
Can you? After the bombing tonight? Try.
He was taken aback by her defiance.
How do I know you're not bluffing?
I'll give you one hint. Remember the man in Australia?
Forrest?
Yes. He tried to tell you the names of the crew. Do you remember the only name he got out?
Kemp.
He died before he could finish it. The name is Kempsey.
That's your lead?
Yes. Kempsey. Name and address. In return for your promise to let me go.
It's a sale, he said. You can go. Give it to me.
She went at once to the travel dress she had worn in Shanghai. From the pocket, she took out a sheet of partially burned paper.
I saw this on Sergei Orel's desk when I was trying to put the fire out. The fire the burning man started.
She handed him the sheet of paper. It was a fragment of a begging letter. It read, "Do anything to get out of these bacteria fields. Why should a man, just because he can't jaunt, get treated like a dog? Please help me, Serg. Help an old shipmate off a ship we don't mention. You can spare 100 credits. Remember all the favors I done you? Send 100 credits, or even 50 credits. Don't let me down. Raj Kempsey, Barrack 3, Bacteria Incorporated, Mare Nubium, Moon."
By God, Foyle exclaimed, this is the lead. We can't fail this time. We'll know what to do. He'll spill everything. Everything,
he grinned at Robin.
We leave for the moon tomorrow night. Book passage. No, there'll be trouble on account of the attack. Buy a ship. They'll be unloading them cheap anyway.
We?
Robin said.
You mean you?
I mean we, Foyle answered. We're going to the moon, both of us.
I'm leaving.
You're not leaving. You're staying with me.
But you swore you'd...
Grow up, girl. I had to swear to anything to get this. I need you more than ever now. Not for Vorga. I'll handle Vorga myself. For something much more important.
He looked at her incredulous face and smiled ruefully.
It's too bad, girl. If you'd given me this letter 2 hours ago, I'd have kept my word. But it's too late now. I need a romance secretary. I'm in love with Olivia Pristine.
She leaped to her feet in a blaze of fury.
You're in love with her? Olivia Pristine? In love with that white corpse?
The bitter fury of her telescending was a startling revelation to him.
Ah, now you have lost me. Forever. Now I'll destroy you.
She disappeared. Chapter 12. Captain Peter Yang Yeovil was handling reports at Central Intelligence HQ in London at the rate of 6 per minute. Information was phoned in, wired in, cabled in, jaunted in. The bombardment picture unfolded rapidly. Attack saturated North and South America from 60 degrees to 120 degrees west longitude. Labrador to Alaska in north,
Rio to Ecuador and south. Estimated 10%. Missiles penetrated interception screen. Estimated population loss, 10 to 12 million.
If it wasn't for jaunting, Yang Yovel said, the losses would have been five times that. All the same, it's close to a knockout. One more punch like that, and Terra's finished.
He addressed this to the assistants jaunting in and out of his office, appearing and disappearing, dropping reports on his desk and chalking results and equations on the glass blackboard, and covered one entire wall. Informality was the rule, and Yang Yovel was surprised and suspicious when an assistant knocked on his door and entered with elaborate formality.
"What larceny now?" he asked.
"Lady to see you, Yo."
"Is this the time for comedy?"
Yang Yovel said in exasperated tones. He pointed to the whitehead equations, spelling disaster on the transparent blackboard.
"Read that and weep on the way out. Very special, Lady Yo. Your Venus from the Spanish Stairs."
"Who? What Venus?"
"Your Congo Venus."
"Oh, that one?"
Yang Yovel hesitated.
"Send her in. You'll interview her in private, of course."
"Of course nothing. There's a war on. Keep those reports coming, but tip everybody to switch to secret speech if they have to talk to me."
Robin Winsbury entered the office, still wearing the torn white evening gown. She had jaunted immediately from New York to London without bothering to change. Her face was strained but lovely. Yang Yovel gave her a split-second inspection and realized that his first appreciation of her had not been mistaken. Robin returned the inspection, and her eyes dilated.
"But you're the cook from the Spanish Stairs, Angelo Poggi."
As an intelligence officer, Yang Yovel was prepared to deal with this crisis.
"Not a cook, madam. I haven't had time to change back to my usual fascinating self. Please sit here, Miss..."
"Winsbury. Robin Winsbury."
"Charmed. I'm Captain Yang Yovel. How nice of you to come and see me, Miss Winsbury. You've saved me a long, hard search."
But I don't understand. What were you doing on the Spanish Stairs? Why were you hunting..."
Yang Yovel saw that her lips weren't moving.
"Ah, you're a telepath, Miss Winsbury. How is that possible? I thought I knew every telepath in the system."
"I'm not a full telepath. I'm a telesend. I can only send, not receive."
"Which, of course, makes you worthless to the world." "I see."
Yang Yovel cocked a sympathetic eye at her.
"What a dirty trick, Miss Winsbury, to be saddled with all the disadvantages of telepathy and be deprived of all the advantages. I do sympathize. Believe me."
"Bless him. He's the first ever to realize that without being told."
"Careful, Miss Winsbury, I'm receiving you. Now, about the Spanish Stairs?"
He paused, listening intently to her agitated telesending.
"Why was he hunting? Me? Alien belief? Oh, God, will they hurt me? Cut in information, I..."
"My dear girl,"
Yang Yovel said gently. He took her hands and held them sympathetically.
"Listen to me a moment. You're alarmed over nothing. Apparently, you're an alien belligerent, yes?"
She nodded.
"That's unfortunate. But we won't worry about it now. About intelligence cutting and slicing information out of people, that's all propaganda."
"Propaganda?"
"We're not maladroits, Miss Winsbury. We know how to extract information without being medieval. But we spread the legend to soften people up in advance, so to speak."
"Is that true? He's lying. It's a trick."
"It's true, Miss Winsbury. I do finesse, but there's no need now. Not when you've evidently come of your own free will to offer information."
"He's too adroit, too quick. He..."
"You sound as though you've been badly tricked recently, Miss Winsbury. Badly burned."
I have. "By myself, mostly. I'm a fool, a hateful fool."
"Never a fool, Miss Winsbury, and never hateful. I don't know what's happened to shatter your opinion of yourself, but I hope to restore it. So, you've been deceived, have you? By yourself, mostly? We all do that. But you've been helped by someone. Who?"
"I'm betraying him."
"Then don't tell me."
"But I've got to find my mother and sisters. I can't trust him anymore. I've got to do it myself."
Robin took a deep breath.
"I want to tell you about a man named Gulliver Foyle."
Yang Yovel at once got down to business.
Is it true he arrived by railroad? Olivia Pristine asked. In a locomotive, an observation car? What wonderful audacity.
Yes, he's a remarkable young man, Pristine answered.
He stood iron gray and iron hard in the reception hall of his home, alone with his daughter. He was guarding honor and life while he waited for servants and staff to return from their panic-stricken jaunt to safety. He chatted imperturbably with Olivia, never once permitting her to realize their grave danger. Father, I'm exhausted.
It's been a trying night, my dear, but please don't retire yet.
Why not?
Pristine refrained from telling her that she would be safer with him. I'm lonely, Olivia. We'll talk for a few minutes.
I did a daring thing, Father. I watched the attack from the garden.
My dear, alone?
No, with 4 Mile. A heavy pounding began to shake the front door, which Pristine had closed.
What's that?
Looters, Pristine answered calmly. Don't be alarmed, Olivia. They won't get in.
He stepped to a table on which he had laid out an assortment of weapons as neatly as a game of patience.
There's no danger, my love, he tried to distract her. You were telling me about 4 Mile.
Oh, yes. We watched together, describing the bombing to each other.
Unchaperoned? That wasn't discreet, Olivia.
I know, I know. I behaved disgracefully. He seemed so big, so sure of himself, that I gave him the Lady Auteur treatment. You remember Miss Post, my governess, who was so dignified and aloof that I called her Lady Auteur? I acted like Miss Post. He was furious, Father. That's why he came looking for me in the garden.
And you permitted him to remain? I'm shocked, dear.
I am too. I think I was half out of my mind with excitement. What's he like, Father? Tell me, what's he look like to you?
He is big. Tall, very dark, rather enigmatic. Like a Borgia. He seems to alternate between assurance and savagery.
Ah, he is savage, then. I could see it myself. He glows with danger. Most people just shimmer. He looks like a lightning bolt. It's terribly fascinating.
My dear, Pristine remonstrated gently, unmarried females are too modest to talk like that. It would displease me, my love, if you were to form a romantic attachment for a parvenu like 4 Mile of Ceres.
The Pristine staff jaunted into the reception hall. Cooks, waitresses, footmen, pages, coachmen, valets, maids. All were shaken and hangdog after their flight from death.
You have deserted your posts. It will be remembered, Pristine said coldly. My safety and honor are again in your hands. Guard them. Lady Olivia and I will retire.
He took his daughter's arm and led her up the stairs, savagely protective of his ice-pure princess.
Blood and money, Pristine murmured.
What, Father?
I was thinking of a family vice, Olivia. I was thanking the deity that you have not inherited it.
What vice is that?
There's no need for you to know. It's one that 4 Mile shares.
Ah, he's wicked. I knew it. Like a Borgia, you said. A wicked Borgia with black eyes and lines in his face. That must account for the pattern.
Pattern, my dear?
Yes. I can see a strange pattern over his face. Not the usual electricity of nerve and muscle. Something laid over that. It fascinated me from the beginning.
What sort of pattern do you mean?
Fantastic. Wonderfully evil. I can't describe it. Give me something to write with. I'll show you.
They stopped before a 600-year-old Chippendale cabinet. Pristine took out a silver-mounted slab of crystal and handed it to Olivia. She touched it with her fingertip. A black dot appeared. She moved her finger and the dot elongated into a line. With quick strokes, she sketched the hideous swirls and blazons of a devil mask. Saul Dagenham left the darkened bedroom. A moment later, it was flooded with light as one wall illuminated. It seemed as though a giant mirror reflected Gisbella's bedroom,
but with one odd quirk. Gisbella lay in the bed alone. But in the reflection, Saul Dagenham sat on the edge of the bed alone. The mirror was, in fact, a sheet of lead glass separating identical rooms. Dagenham had just illuminated his. "Love by the clock," Dagenham's voice came through a speaker. "Disgusting." "No, Saul, never."
"Frustrating."
"Not that either."
"But unhappy."
"No, you're greedy. Be content with what you've got."
"It's more than I ever had. You're magnificent."
"You're extravagant. Now go to sleep, darling. We're skiing tomorrow."
"No, there's been a change of plan. I've got to work."
"Oh, Saul, you promised me. No more working and fretting and running. Aren't you going to keep your promise?"
"I can't with a war on."
"To hell with the war. You sacrificed enough up at Tycho Sands. They can't ask any more of you."
"I've got one job to finish."
"I'll help you finish it."
"No. You'd best keep out of this, Gisbella."
"You don't trust me."
"I don't want you hurt."
"Nothing can hurt us."
"Foil can."
What?
4 Mile is Foil. You know that. I know you know."
"But I never..."
"No, you never told me. You're magnificent. Keep faith with me the same way, Gisbella."
"Then how did you find out?"
"Foil slipped."
"How?"
"The name."
4 Mile of Ceres? He bought the Ceres company."
"But Jeffrey 4 Mile?"
"He invented it."
"He thinks he invented it. He remembered it. Jeffrey 4 Mile is the name they use in the megalomania test down in Combined Hospital in Mexico City. I used the megalmood on Foil when I tried to open him up. The name must have stayed buried in his memory. He dredged it up and thought it was original. That tipped me."
"Poor Gully."
Dagenham smiled. "Yes, no matter how we defend ourselves against the outside, we're always licked by something from the inside. There's no defense against betrayal, and we all betray ourselves."
"What are you going to do, Saul?"
"Do? Finish him, of course."
"For 20 pounds of pyre?"
"No, to win a lost war." End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.